So our next speaker is Peyton Young. It's a great pleasure to introduce Peyton. Peyton is a colleague here in the Senior Fellow in Economic Studies. He and I were also former colleagues at the University of Maryland some years ago. He's now also the James Mead Professor of Economics at Oxford University. And he's going to talk today about why transparency matters. Peyton, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm here really in a capacity as an economist, not a hedge fund manager, not as a financial analyst. I want to briefly run through some ideas about transparency. This has been a theme that has recurred in almost every single presentation so far, and I suspect it will be in the remaining panel as well. And there are a lot of dimensions in which transparency matters. Broadly speaking, from an economic point of view, markets operate most efficiently if there is transparency of information. And in fact, in the case of financial entities, assets, trading, funds, and so forth, risk and information about risk is the key. To the extent that the investing public, whether the investing public consists of highly sophisticated, rich individuals, such as typically would invest in hedge funds, or the broader public, all of those people need as great a degree of information, reliable information, as they can get. I do not accept, by the way, the notion that somehow sophisticated or high net worth individuals are different in this respect. They all need lots of information, and actually this is one of the things that government is quite good at providing, a framework in which information is given to the public at large. Analogies abound. One of them is, of course, what we take for granted, food and drug labeling. Just the simple matter of labeling things that you consume, that you put in your mouth, is a key part of the way in which markets function efficiently for foods and drugs. It's sort of so obvious. We take this for granted. There was a time when this wasn't provided. I would submit that kind of transparency in the hedge fund industry and more broadly in other related kinds of entities, investment entities, will go a long way toward improving the efficiency and reliability of these markets. Part of the twist I want to put on this is the issue of confidence. The reason that information and transparency is so important is it enhances investor confidence in making those investments, in putting their money in certain entities and not in others. When the information is lacking, confidence can not only decline, it can literally collapse. And that can cause severe problems and great inefficiencies for a long period of time. I'm afraid that we're looking at such a time right now. There has been a collapse of confidence that you know what you're getting when you invest in various entities. And of course, this applies not only to hedge funds, it applies to some of the things we were talking about earlier, the banks. What are these toxic assets? We don't want to invest in them because we don't know what's there. So that's the broader theme that I want to emphasize. It's not detailed regulatory intervention. It's an informational scheme that the government can help support by appropriate agencies and by appropriate legislation. Now, what I want to do, though, is, since this is about hedge funds specifically, I want to walk through a couple of examples which to some practitioners in the audience will be reasonably familiar, not that surprising. It's all about what happens when you don't have transparency, and I mean you don't have any transparency. What can go wrong? I want to, since a number of people will not be familiar with this, I'd like to go through a couple of examples and then come back to some of the broader policy implications. So I'm going to refer to the so-called black box investing model. First of all, it's been said, and I emphasize it again, hedge funds constitute an enormous universe, some of which, in fact, will not fall at all under this rubric. They are registered, they provide all kinds of information to their investors about what they are and are not investing in. They run due diligence, they have regular audits, they have, you know, beautifully presented returns. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about the other part of the hedge fund universe that does not do this. And there is a very significant part that does not. They basically operate a black box model. We could name names. Some of the biggest hedge funds in the industry actually still do this. Pretty much you cannot find out if you're just an ordinary but high net worth individual wanting to invest in these. You can't find out what they are doing, and they won't tell you. Nothing. They will report returns, and that's about it. That's what I call black box investing. All you see are the returns. The audited returns say once a quarter, once a year, that's it. You have a history of the returns. Now, I claim that, unfortunately, that is very, very easy to fake. And it's fake can be faked not in the sense of Bernard Madoff. So again, I want to sort of draw a distinction between what is in the news now, a Madoff or Ponzi scheme, assuming that it is a Ponzi scheme. We don't actually, by the way, know completely what sort of a scheme it was. Let's say it was a Ponzi scheme. This is a different kind of scheme. I'll explain how it works. Hedge fund managers, and indeed quite a few private partnerships of one sort and another, can engage in a whole lot of options trading strategies, often called dynamic trading strategies. And this uses the wizardry of financial engineering and the huge number of financial instruments now available that were not available, say, or not widely available 20 or 30 years ago. But while all of that is very good and in principle efficiency enhancing, what you can do with these options and various forms of derivatives is you can manipulate the distribution of returns to make it look as if you're generating above average returns when in fact you are not doing so. This has been given various names. Some people call it fake alpha. Some people call it beta masquerading as alpha. Black swans, you know, there's some colorful language to go along with this. It all amounts to the same thing. What I'm going to do is walk you through a very, very simple example, appallingly simple. I hope that nobody in the hedge fund universe that's here would ever think of doing this, but it can be done. Here is a picture of, say, my hedge fund run according to my method. And that's the red line. And now the blue line is just a straight line. That's the return on T-bills, basically, over the last decade. And the red line is my reported returns. And I claim this is absolute alpha. This is a way I say this is uncorrelated with the stock market. So it's a dandy investment, and it's way, way above T-bill returns. But the whole thing is a fake. And the reason it is a fake is that the way I generate this is that I invest in the T-bills all right, and then I invest, I take positions, short positions in puts on some other entity, say some stock market or other, and these are out of the money puts, and it's very unlikely that they'll be exercised. And when I do this, I absolutely bet the ranch, meaning I get a position going, which, if it ever were to materialize against me, my entire fund will be cleaned out. But it's unlikely that this will happen. How unlikely, we're going to go over in just a minute. And if it doesn't happen, the payment I get, in effect, is that it juices up the current returns. And these are bona fide returns. These are not fraudulent. I want to emphasize this. We're not talking fraud here. It's only fraud if I said I wasn't doing this. If in the prospectus I said I am not going to hold derivatives, say, but I did anyway. That's fraud. But this is not, this is merely a bet. It's a betting model. You can do this against T-bills. You can do this against the Standard & Poor's. You can do this against a wide variety of underlying assets. And basically, my co-author and I call this piggybacking. You're basically padding or building up a return of some underlying asset by an appreciable amount, and you're doing this for two reasons. First, you want to earn the fees that go along with that. In the hedge fund business, that's often 20% of that gap between the T-bill rate and what you're producing in the red line. Let's go back to this. That would be a big gap. I'm going to take 20% of that difference. Okay, this is a very attractive return. The second thing is that I'm not reporting what's driving this. I say, well, that's a proprietary strategy. All you can see is my returns, and I attract new money by doing this. So unless you are contradicting some information you're providing to your investors, this isn't, strictly speaking, a legal fraud. It's definitely not a Ponzi scheme. I'm not using payments into the fund by Peter to pay Paul. That's how that works, and that's fraud. That's fraudulent conveyance. This is not a fraudulent conveyance. In fact, one of the ways that we work this is all the positions we assume are fully covered and paid for. All the options are covered. There's no issue here of I won't be able to meet margin calls. If you do that, you can invent even fancier schemes. I want to keep this very simple to illustrate that you can really look good and not generate any excess returns in fact. The reported returns look very good, but what's going to happen? Why, what is eventually going to happen? Well, of course, eventually the fund's going to go bust. There's a hidden black swan there. There it is. Happened in late 2008. That fund, that red fund that looked so wonderful and was drawing in new money, crashed in December of 2008. This is a simulation. This is a made-up example, but it's used to illustrate this point. These things can run for a very surprisingly long period of time before the truth is revealed. How long? Well, we can do a little calculation. X is the piggybacking amount, say you're padding by 5% or 10% or 15%, and over on the right-hand side is the expected number of years before that bust will actually materialize. Look at the, with a 5% padding, you can just basically run till you retire. With the middle one, you still got 11 years to go on average, and maybe you'll go a whole lot longer and you won't get caught. Now you might say, well, no rational manager would do that. They want to stay in business for 20 or 30 years. Well, there are different kinds of managers, aren't there? Some might find that this is a pretty good deal, actually. So, well, what are the investors? Why are the investors going for this? They don't know that that's what is going on. And this is one of the problems with the, I hate to use the hedge fund industry as a, it's an umbrella that covers a huge variety of different styles of management and degrees of voluntary disclosure. But let's just use it as a sort of a placeholder for now. In principle, you can get away with this under the current regulatory environment. That's just a fact. And furthermore, I'll have to tell you that when I've given the same talk at hedge fund management conferences, I've been told privately by a number of people that they know other people in the business who are pretty much doing this. So I submit, although we can't measure how much it's going on, there's reason to think it is going on. Also, it can go on to a partial degree, and I think this, unfortunately, could be quite widespread. You've got a great long-short trading strategy. You've got some proprietary method, but in a given year or a given quarter, it's not going so well. Gee, it's awfully tempting to pull one of these stunts just for a quarter or just for a year to sort of get through that and hope you don't get cleaned out. So there may be partial implementations of this going on. But again, the investors cannot tell unless they're provided much more detailed information. I'm going to talk about the nature of that information in a minute. And why is this important? Well, you could say that investors are simply being foolish. I mean, they should not simply look at the return series. They should demand much more. But unfortunately, that's like saying that there are some drugs in the store that don't have content labels. And people are buying them because they think they're going to get well if they take those drugs. My own view of this is that there's a broad remit of government that needs to provide some sort of safety net, both for sophisticated and unsophisticated investors, and that means basically some form of labeling. What is in this and how risky is it? That doesn't mean you have to give away the proprietary strategy any more than listing what's on a drug or a food as content gives away what the formula is. It's just not so. Furthermore, in fact, there are ways of aggregating the information so that you really don't give much away at all. The deeper point, though, is that even if we weren't in our current environment, one Bernard Madoff can trigger a collapse of confidence because suddenly people realize what they should have realized earlier, that they really don't know what they've gotten themselves into. And when you're dealing with a black box model, this is the problem. It's a problem actually not only for the investors, I submit, it's a problem for the industry. The industry itself has a strong interest in promoting greater transparency. That's the message of this talk. And why is this? Because there are a lot of great players out there. They're very good. They are generating value for their investors. But they're going to be pulled down, too, if there's a collapse of confidence. So here are sort of my concluding points, or two. First, there are a number of reforms with weak teeth, or let's call them dentures. They aren't going to do the trick. And in fact, they could be worse than useless because they give a false sense of security to the investor community. And what are those? Some of the standard value at risk measures are really easy to circumvent using variants of the strategy I just said. They are very weak and not adequate. Much in the air is the idea of postponing managers' fees. Well, it'll go some distance, but it's pretty easy to get around that too using, again, a variant of the method that I'm talking about. What about assessing personal penalties? I.e., you've got to post a personal bond as a manager, and if you do badly, not only are you not going to get paid a bonus, you're going to be out some money that was in an escrow account. This, of course, would be draconian. I've never even heard of a scheme like this except for Lloyd's of London, where the names actually have personal liability for their investments. But this would be a radical solution. But even that won't work. Why? Because basically it means that even the smart managers, the startup guys, aren't even going to want to participate in the scheme to begin with. Either they don't have a personal bond to post, or they won't want to do it. That leaves us then with, in my view, some steps should be taken. It's in the interest of the industry to take those steps, but they are fairly mild. As somebody who does research in this area, I have to tell you that the amount of data, reliable data, about hedge fund returns is appallingly low. Hedge funds need to be registered as inception. Their managers' names need to be known. All of this must be returns have to be audited frequently and publicly by an auditing firm with expertise in the relevant financial instruments. And finally, what is not the case now, unless it's voluntary, when a fund closes down, we don't even know the final value paid out to the investors. So actually, this business about crashes, and that causes the fund to close down, we don't even know how often this is occurring in the data. So as an absolute minimum, I would suggest, and I don't think this is terribly controversial, we need to have registration, regular reporting on the part of all hedge funds, and I actually think it's in the interest of the leaders in the industry to promote that. Thank you very much.
Seats. Okay, well, my laptop is getting mic'd up. I think we can get started. My name is Sebastian Malaby. I direct the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'll be moderating the second panel where we're going to talk about the emerging regulatory environment for hedge funds. We've got a terrific group to talk about this. On the very end there is Professor Andrew Lowe, the Harris and Harris. Is this mic on? There you go. Maybe I should have this higher. How's that? I will try and speak up. So at the end there is Professor Andrew Lowe from MIT, Harris and Harris Group Professor of Finance. He's written a lot on hedge funds, including a book which I think came out last year, and has testified before the House Oversight Committee on Hedge Funds. The next is Peyton Young, you've just heard from, at the Brookings Institution. Then there is Jim Chanos, referred to many times in the previous panel as the famous short seller, quote unquote. His fund is called Kinnikus, am I pronouncing that right? Yep. Associates. And he is at the president of the Coalition of Private Investment Companies, which is an investment fund industry group. And next to me, you've heard already this morning from Glenn Hutchins, a trustee here at Brookings and co-founder and CEO of Silver Lake, a private equity firm in New York, and part owner of the Boston Celtics. I think we're going to start with opening remarks from everybody. So why don't we go first to Andrew Lowe to give some opening remarks.
Well, first I want to start by thanking the Brookings Institution for inviting me here today. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I'm also affiliated with an asset management company that manages hedge funds, as well as my academic activities. I won't say too much at the start, because I think the most interesting part of this panel will be the interaction with the audience questions. But the regulation of hedge funds, I think, is a very important issue that has obviously surfaced over the last few months. And in the research that I've done with my co-authors over the last few years, we've been calling for more transparency to regulators, because the systemic risk posed by hedge funds can be considerable. Obviously, the hedge fund industry is an incredibly valuable part of the economy. It's one of the most vibrant parts of the financial services industry. And frankly, the hedge fund industry is one of the reasons why we've experienced such tremendous growth in the real economy over the last couple of decades. But at the same time, there's a number of systemic issues that have been arisen because hedge funds engage in such a wide variety of activities, and because there isn't any central regulatory authority that understands the risk exposures. But I think that it's possible to have our cake and eat it too, in terms of being able to benefit from the capital building benefits of hedge funds, while at the same time providing limited disclosure of the systemic exposures to regulators. And the hope is that over the next few months, we'll see new regulations drafted to affect those changes.
Okay, Peyton, do you want to say something? Or you felt you
no, I'll start? Pass.
Okay, let's go to Jim Chanos.
Thank you, Sebastian, and thanks again to Brookings for doing this. I think this is a tremendous forum for getting these issues out, and the timing couldn't be better. I'll make a few remarks about hedge fund regulation going forward, but just in a move one step backwards to the previous panels to where we've come, I would stress to everyone that, in fact, despite the federal courts dropping the SEC's move to register on a mandatory basis hedge funds, we've had hedge funds regulated for the past number of years by federal agencies. They were called Lehman Brothers. They were called Bear Stearns. And I say this only half tongue in cheek, because what drove those entities into the ground was, in effect, their proprietary trading desks. And the residuals that they kept on their books from their securitization activities, where the accounting was, if not questionable, outright fraudulent, in my opinion. More on that later. So again, to my questions earlier to the panel and to speakers, and to Senator Reid, keep in mind that more regulation doesn't mean better regulation. We need smart regulation. We really need people who've sat on trading desks, people who've run hedge funds, people who've run investment firms to be SEC commissioners, to be new risk regulators, to be systemic risk regulators if we end up with that. Where are these people? They are few and far between. We need to call them into public service and to get them on behalf of the U.S. citizenry and the taxpayer to safeguard their investments and to safeguard the financial system. Unfortunately, we have seemingly, from the industry's perspective, too much of a revolving door of the people who are at the top of our regulatory environment over and over and again with very, very well-educated and well-meaning staffs below them who are simply overwhelmed because in many cases they don't have the day-to-day experience of the types of businesses of which they're regulating. And I can't stress that enough. I think it was FDR who put the biggest short seller of his day, Joe Kennedy, as the first chair of the SEC, saying something like, who better to guard the hen house but the chief fox?
Are you looking for that job too?
No. It just makes my point, Sebastian, that we need people, the Julian Robertsons of the world, people like that who have maybe made their money but have a sense of give back, to add their weight of years and experience to basically help these again, very well-meaning staffs and guide them the right way and what to look for and what might be problematic in the future. Having said all that, our industry knows that it will become part of the regulatory framework. We fully expect it. Our organization, CPIC, expects to cooperate fully with our membership in being part of that process and being part of that dialogue. I think for the industry to stand outside with its nose pressed against the window would be the height of irresponsibility and foolishness. We hope that we can stress the role that hedge funds do play in capital formation and in price discovery, not least of which, from my perspective, also as real-time financial watchdogs, which is not discussed enough in terms of the role hedge funds played in warning our regulators in 06 and 07 about some of the looming problems. Those warnings were by and large ignored. So I think that the industry stands ready to be part of that dialogue. I know there's going to be a wide variety of ancillary subjects that are going to come part and parcel with that. Taxation, for example. The whole concept of offshore funds, I think, is going to be revisited, and our organization thinks that it probably should be revisited. Corollary items would be possibly some sort of watering down or elimination of UBTI, which is an anachronism, in my opinion, and prevents an awful lot of capital from going to domestic fund managers, instead being forced offshore for no good reason. In fact, one could argue the whole offshore structure, from an optics point of view, probably should go away. And I think, personally, I would applaud attempts to make that happen. Furthermore, the issues of transparency, which were touched on the last presentation and in the previous panel, I think will be discussed pretty aggressively on both sides. I can argue that better transparency is, of course, almost always good, but that proprietary information is, as Professor Angel said, is something that also needs to be protected. For if I have to put out my entire portfolio every 90 days, I think that that intellectual property that my clients pay good money for, is given out for free 4 times a year. I would have a problem with that. Disclosing positions to regulators, I think almost nobody at this point in the hedge fund industry has any problem with. And my guess is we're going to see some sort of regime like that going forward. As to better transparency for investors, I'm all for it. These are private deals, typically between the investor and the manager. I would love to have lots of investors of the type you were referring to, who apparently do no due diligence whatsoever. I've found that not to be the case, unfortunately, in my fundraising activities. I spend an awful lot of time, as does my CFO and my head of research and my head of trading, going through all sorts of processes, people looking at trades, looking at past trades. Although I do think some piggybacking type strategies have occurred, and in fact in 2 or 3 large circumstances still continue, I think that anyone in this day and age who gives their money to a manager who says, I'm just simply not going to tell you what I'm doing with your money, really ought to have their head examined. But I guess, as they say, there's a sucker born every minute. And finally, to that end, I would point out to something that kind of went a little bit unnoticed in the days leading up to the inauguration, and that was the release of the President's Working Group best practices proposals put out by the investment managers and also by the Investors Committee. There were two committees that the President's Working Group empowered 2 years ago to come up with a first stab at U.S. best practices for hedge funds. And one of the things that I would point out to our previous speaker, which might help, is that in the evaluation section, which committee I was on, we went to great lengths to take the FAS 157 rules on asset valuation, the so-called level 1, 2, and 3 assets, and not only embrace that as we had to under GAAP for purposes of disclosure, but we took it one step further. We asked that managers embracing our best practice proposals actually give their investors, either quarterly or annually, an attribution table as to how much of their profits and losses, both realized and unrealized, came from level 1, level 2, and level 3 assets.
You just explained level 1 is equity.
Level 1 would be the Professor Bailey's example, level 1 would be the S&P you bought. Level 2 typically are derivatives and anything pricing off of something else based on observable inputs. So the short put transaction, custom put transaction would fall under, in his example, would fall under level 2 assets. Level 3 are what I call marked to this, on the oxymoronic phrase of unobservable inputs, which really means management's best guess. And level 3 is where we've really had the problem, in my opinion, in our banks and brokers, or shadow hedge funds, as I dub them. So using the professor's example, in his case, you would see immediately how much of the attribution, even if he wasn't telling you what he was doing, was come from level 1 assets, the S&P, and then the short puts, you would see that as the level 2 profit and loss. And at least it would give investors a guideline as to questions to ask their managers. And of course, if the hedge fund was deriving most of their profits and paying most of the performance fees to its managers based on level 2 and level 3 unrealized gains and losses, I would think that would be a great red flag. So I commend anyone to go to the President's Working Group release that was done in January. The Paulson Treasury put it out, I think, a day before they left office, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle, quite literally. But I think there's some very good proposals in there that really haven't been picked up on by the press that the hedge fund industry that wrote this feels pretty good about, particularly in regards to enhanced disclosure.
Okay, thanks. Glenn.
Well, I think James has said some very thoughtful and astute things. Maybe we ought to just close the panel now. I'll make just three.
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. I'll make just three very quick comments because I think you said most of what is the right thing, the right way to introduce the subject. But one is that I want to amplify something Professor Lowe said. We can't lose track of the fact that the hedge funds as an industry have been a source of capital that have both made the markets more efficient, much more efficient, in large part, not entirely, but short selling is an aspect of efficiency of the capital markets and more information coming out. And when you make decisions like that we made it earlier this year, or later last year, pardon me, to ban short selling in certain instruments for certain periods of time, you are significantly reducing market efficiency. And the hedge funds have been a real force for funding entrepreneurial and innovative activities. And that's something which we also don't want to de-emphasize. As we get into regulation, you don't want to have a Sarbanes-Oxley style regulation of the hedge fund industry that becomes sort of the regulatory equivalent of bleeding the patient. We need to be very, very careful about that. I was struck and very pleased by the moderate and highly informed tone that Senator Reid took earlier today. I think we're sort of on the right path in that regard. I'd say, secondly, you alluded to something which I think is very important, which is that the hedge fund-like activity takes place inside of lots of different kinds of institutions. Yep. It doesn't just happen at probably these private, unregulated, or lightly regulated, because there is a lot of regulation that goes on at the investment level, at least. Partnerships. It happens inside of banks, inside of what were used to be investment banks, and insurance companies, et cetera, et cetera. those type of investing activities. And I think one of the things the regulators are going to have to think hard about is what kinds of activities that allow deposit taking systemically important, too big to fail institutions to do. I think that's where this notion that there was this issue on Wall Street and it was the hedge fund's fault misses the fact that a lot of the problem comes from these types of assets being on the banks, being on the balance sheets of banks, and them not doing as good a job with it as people who were directly bearing the risk more themselves in the hedge fund industry. And I think third, the other dimension of this, and I come at this now from the point of view, I've been a fiduciary for institutions that invest in hedge funds, among other things. The third dimension that people paid much less attention to, and the hedge funds have been much less good about than the industry had expected, is liquidity. The real issue right now, and some of the level one, two, and three gets to that because almost by definition, a level three is illiquid. If you can't observe it, it means it's not trading, right?
It's one problem.
Exactly. So. When people, people thought they had certain kinds of liquidity with in the hedge funds, they went to get their money out and the gates went up. They thought the hedge funds were investing in many cases, instruments that were liquid that turned out not to be liquid. Many hedge funds are now restructuring themselves to take these illiquid things they own and put them in different pockets and sort of manage those out over time. So people are quite surprised by the liquidity dimension of what they got themselves into. And I think that's a dimension I haven't heard much discussion about in the regulatory debate, but it's something that needs to be paid a lot of attention to, certainly from a disclosure point of view. That'll be a dimension, I think, which as we get into this, people will want to pay more attention to.
It was the biggest self-inflicted wound, I think, the hedge fund industry gave itself last year. It wasn't performance, it was the gating.
Exactly.
I agree with you 100%. And it was something I think my industry really needs to do a better job both explaining and improving upon.
Right. Let me just press on. I mean, it seems like one idea in this space that seems to command a lot of consensus is transparency. Both Peyton Young's talk before and Andrew Lowe's opening comments refer to this. Can I just get maybe Professor Lowe, first of all, to focus on one potential downside, it seems to me. There are clearly gains from transparency, but it seems to me if you look at what Goldman Sachs, for example, did last year, in making lists of stocks that were intensively held by hedge funds, and then bundling these into a tradable basket and saying, look, guys, we know that hedge funds are deleveraging. How's about you go short this basket of hedge fund intensive stocks because we know they're going down? This is an example where forced disclosure through required filings by hedge funds of positions enables a broker to target positions of hedge funds and increase the volatility in the market. Isn't that right?
Well, I think that's right. Transparency is a two-edged sword, and I think one has to be very careful about how you wield it. I'd like to make the distinction between position transparency, which is what you're talking about, and risk transparency, which is what I think investors really want and need. For a number of hedge fund strategies that involve, in some cases, thousands of positions, giving an investor position transparency does nothing to allay his or her fears about what's going on with the fund. What investors need, and what I think hedge fund managers will have no problem providing, is risk transparency, which is, what kind of risk exposures can I expect if I invest in this fund based upon the complex strategies that the fund is engaging in? And so I think that that's a very important distinction where we can have our cake and eat it too. We can provide, using sophisticated risk analytics, risk transparency without jeopardizing the intellectual property that hedge fund managers work so hard and investors pay so much money for. A good example of this is Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is a publicly traded company. We have a lot of information about it, but I don't think we want to compel Coca-Cola to post its formula on its website because that reduces the economic value that its founders and its investors created. And I think in the same way for hedge funds that are engaged in these kinds of strategies, it's possible to provide investors, regulators, with the kind of risk transparency that they need to manage those risks while at the same time protecting the economic value that hedge fund managers create.
Can I just jump in, though? The problem is that some of the standard plain vanilla risk measures are not adequate to
That's right.
task. And so my worry is that we'll get some sort of mandate to do this, but with the wrong risk measure. Mm-hmm. And then investors could be lulled into complacency. I mean, one of the problems that you can is so-called dynamic trading strategies, where you can, in very short periods of time, take on a series of positions depending on what happened the minute before and the hour before that, which can undermine at least a lot of the more simplistic risk measures. And so it's a big challenge for the profession to design the right ones.
Let me just sort of see if I can therefore draw out 2 points from what you've just said. Everyone agrees on transparency, but Professor Slow says he does not mean position transparency. That sounds right to me, but I would just observe that whenever there has been any disclosure to the government, SEC filings and so forth, in fact, it has been position transparency. So if we're going to go down this road, it sounds like you would agree that the common understanding in Washington of what transparency might entail needs to change. Now, building on that, Peyton Young says, yes, but you know the analytics have to be sophisticated ones. They can't be simple ones. And this gets to a point that you know we might want transparency, but do we know how to require the right sort that it would actually help? And let me press on one particular issue that I think is key here, and that is that to understand the systemic risk inherent in any trading strategy, you have to know what everybody else is doing in the same trading strategy. It's all about crowding. It's all about, is somebody else doing the same thing, so that if this guy over here blows up, it's going to have a knock-on effect in 10 other guys who are also leveraged in the same trade. We are never, surely this is right, we are never going to know
good luck with that.
Who is in one space, because it could be a Brazilian trading company.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? Isn't this just a fool's errand to get to...
Well, can I address that? I actually think that there's a greater possibility of creating exactly that kind of systemic transparency than you might think. And the reason is that you don't have to go to the thousands of hedge funds to get that information. All you need to do is to go to the very small handful of prime brokers that all hedge funds route their trades through. There are probably 5 to 10 major prime brokers.
Not anymore.
Smaller now. But these are brokers that act as brokers for hedge funds.
Makes it easier.
And if you approach the prime brokers and ask them to disclose information, say to the Fed or to the regulatory authorities, you can very quickly and very efficiently aggregate the picture that you're looking for, namely what the exposures are system-wide across all hedge funds. And you can do it in a very anonymous and a very efficient manner, so that it's really quite doable, in my opinion. It just requires the particular regulatory authority to be able to do that.
Ken. You also have this very important, I think it's a very good point. You also have information that you can gather from exchanges and clearinghouses, because there's a huge amount of price information and volume information that comes from exchanges. Part of the problem, for instance, in the CDS market was that it was an OTC market without an exchange, without a clearinghouse. So I think there are some regulatory mechanisms that are market-based mechanisms you can set up that allow you to gather lots of information about these things. So I was going to make two other points I would make. One is that I think you make a distinction between position data being published for the world to see and position data being available for the regulators to see. Right. I think that might be a distinction that you end up with. So the regulators.
The industry is clearly hoping that that's the distinction that's made.
Right.
And I don't think anybody any more reasonably thinks from our side of the table that disclosing to the regulators and risk monitors is something that they should reasonably fight.
But I think our discussion shows that it's an open question. Politically, I think you're right. But whether this actually is going to help anything depends
on
what gets disclosed.
That's different, right? but the distinction is that I don't think anybody, it sounds like the industry's not fighting position information being available in a confidential manner to the regulator who's evaluating systemic risk. Right, what they're fighting is that becoming available generally.
Giving away our intellectual property.
Right. So I think you'll have a lot of more that's an important distinction, so the regulator can have the information necessary to do the regulatory job. But the other thing that's going to be interesting and important is that the people who own these assets oftentimes have the investors in these assets have their own reciprocal obligations to do FAS 157 accounting for their own balance sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of information they need, the question will be, is level one, level two, level three enough information for them to be able to certify their own financial statements? Right? Or are they going to need more of this kind of position-like information? Is there, and that'll probably be as a result, there'll probably be some private contract work that'll happen between the GP and the LP in that regard. But that's another place where the quality and depth of the information becomes very important.
Can I just make one point, Sebastian? One thing that the hedge fund industry also worries about, as we're talking about the regulatory framework and sort of the constitutional protection of intellectual property and risk management, there are some asymmetries at work here from the legal point of view. And in particular, one of the things the industry is worried about is issuer retaliation in a full disclosure regime. And we raised this with the SEC in August when they did the first set of the so-called Gang of 19 restricted pre-borrows and shorting. And one of the points we made was that there is an asymmetry due to human nature and due to the legal system, particularly in the U.S., in which if positions, large short positions, were disclosed by investor to the marketplace, there's a very easy way for the CEOs of questionable companies to squelch true public debate about their accounting practices or their business practices, if in fact those are in question. And that is to simply take an aggregate look of everybody who short their stock, file a RICO suit in state court with shareholder money. And what's the first thing your lawyers do when you're part of a RICO suit as a defendant, no matter how frivolous, it tells you to shut up. Stop talking. Don't say anything. Don't write research reports. Don't talk to reporters about the funny accounting. Wait till the court's done. And that has a very, very chilling effect on the so-called price discovery issue, in very legitimate issues. I can only imagine if Enron had had a list of everybody short their stock prior to that collapse, I have no doubt Skilling and Company would have gone that route if they had that tool available to themselves.
Let me make a connection between what Glenn said about exchanges and the earlier discussion over there. See, it seems to me that we've actually been, I'm writing a history of hedge funds, so I'm sort of steeped in this, but there have been other moments in the past, whether after the 94 bond market collapse or the 98 LTCM episode, where regulators have taken a hard look at hedge funds and they've never done anything. And they've never done anything because actually they couldn't think of good things to do. And it strikes me that in listening to Professor Lowe, who you've testified in Congress, you've advocated various measures, but if what you're saying actually that the best way to get a handle on the types of risk you think are relevant is through prime brokers, you sound to me like you're going back to the consensus of 1998, where the idea was you go to the providers of the leverage, the prime brokers, and you try and monitor excess leverage through the brokers, not at the hedge fund level because there's too many of them and so forth. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
That's right. I think that it would be impractical to try to manage that kind of regulatory oversight at the level of the hedge fund. There's just too many of them. And by the way, I'm not arguing that one shouldn't ask hedge funds to register, but in my view, registration solves a different problem. Registration is all about investor protection, mm-hmm. which is important and legitimate, but it has nothing to do with systemic risk.
Yeah, right,
so
that's right.
I would look at those two things very separately, and for the purposes of addressing systemic risk, dealing with the prime brokers is both more efficient and more effective.
Is a panelist allowed to ask a question instead of answer it?
All right.
So what kind of an agency, what would an agency look like that has the expertise to investigate the question of systemic risk?
Well, I've actually written about that kind of an agency. I propose that we create a new agency patterned after the National Transportation Safety Board, which I've called the Capital Market Safety Board for lack of anything better. The NTSB, as many of you know, is the agency that is actually an independent part of the government. It has no regulatory authority whatsoever, but it's the organization that swoops in and at every plane crash, collects the black box, reassembles the plane, and ultimately engages in a forensic examination and produces a publicly available report that provides everyone with complete transparency about what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and how we might prevent it from happening again. And having an agency like the National Transportation Safety Board for capital markets to examine every single blow-up go through that process of sifting through the wreckage, I think would provide a great deal of information about how we can prevent these things from happening again.
Can I now play devil's advocate as having raised the question now? I mean, so suppose that agency were in, you know, operating today. Well, first of all, it would be doing a land office business. A land office business. And then the argument would come out that nobody would ever get in a plane again because they'd be investigating 100 down planes. And, of course, that would undermine sort of the broad confidence in the financial industry itself. So this, it sounds, I love this suggestion. On the other hand, if it's one at a time, it sounds okay, but if there actually is a systemic event, which we're experiencing now, then I could see that an agency like this could contribute to the fear.
Actually, I would disagree with that. I think that what contributes to fear is lack of understanding, not greater understanding. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, a US air flight ended up in the Hudson River, New York City. And at first, nobody knew what happened. And so naturally, given that if you're in New York and you've spent the last few years there, the first thing that would come to your mind is terrorist attack. And it would have been very easy for there to have mass panic ensue in New York City shortly after this flight went into the Hudson. But the NTSB took control of the situation immediately, held a press conference, and while they didn't have any obvious answers at the time, they had a conjecture, which they communicated to the press, and they described that it might be a flock of geese, and this has happened in the past so many times, and these are the things that we're going to do. This kind of transparency produces trust, confidence, and a sense of calm. And I think the reason that we are in such a crisis today is precisely because of lack of transparency, lack of understanding, and lack of trust. The most potent kind of fear is the fear of the unknown, and that's what we're in today.
Who wants to say something?
I read your piece, and I think your proposal is a very interesting one. The problem with it is, I think gathering the information and getting the lessons learned and having that available is a good tool. The problem with it is it's backward-looking, not forward-looking. And it's based, you look at individual events as opposed to systemic issues. There are many proposals being brooded about because, remember, hedge fund industry regulation, while very important, is going to be one piece of a much larger program for the reform of our financial markets regulation in general. And one large piece of this is clearly going to be a systemic regulator, someone who's given a mandate for that. My personal view, just completely personal view, is it's best put at a place where there is the greatest degree of professionalism and the lowest degree of politicization, and that's probably the Fed. But we'll see what happens. But that will be, this will and should be an important part of the mandate of the systemic regulator, looking at the hedge fund industry as one of the players in the overall financial service industry, just rather than regulating and thinking about its systemic issues individually or in a microcosm.
But then comes the question, okay, supposing you do this and you have this systemic regulator, which includes the component that Professor Lowe is talking about, what do you do with that finding? Because I think that I know roughly the recurring theme in hedge funds that have gone bust, whether it's Michael Steinhardt in 1994, Tiger in 2000, LTCM in 1998, the Druckenmiller version of the Soros Fund in 2000. All of these guys did one thing. They went into a position which they thought they could get out of, and then it turned illiquid, and they couldn't get out. Everybody who manages money knows this, but the question is, you know, how do you implement that? How do you avoid being trapped? Because there can be liquidity one day and then it dries up.
Can I respond to that? Because I think it's a very important point, this notion that illiquidity is a very, very potent component of these crises. And the reason that there was so much illiquidity surrounding those events that you described is because the particular managers involved had very large positions but had no idea that so many other people had similar large positions precisely because of that lack of transparency. And so the problem is not so much leverage by itself, but it's the combination, the unholy mixture of leverage and illiquidity. And so the question of what you would do about it, what a regulator would do about it, if a regulator had information that a large number of hedge funds and other financial institutions had very, very similar positions and they were building to a catastrophe kind of a scenario, they could at that point start to impose a leverage constraints, put on the brakes, and engage in what policymakers now call counter-cyclical policy.
So, I mean, I agree with that, and this kind of gets to the point earlier about crowding.
Yeah.
Trades are dangerous when they're crowded, right?
Wait a minute. Look. Every one of those investors you cited is and was a world-class investor.
True. Mm-hmm.
I know them all personally. Every one of them, I can bet you a bottom dollar, knew full well that there were lots of people on the same side of the trade they were. And they took a judgment that may often has panned out, and in this case, didn't pan out. Those were investment decisions gone wrong. I don't know that they would have happened any other way.
But that's sort of my point, that these are world-class people. I've interviewed them all. They go into it, and they took a risk, and the risk went wrong. And
exactly.
So it's not an indictment of the rest of their career. It's precisely the point that even the most successful people can make this mistake. We're not going to limit the mistake. Even if we had the NTSB come in and do the post-mortem and tell you how it all went wrong, it wouldn't prevent very good investors from making the mistake because we've run the experiment. They did make the mistake.
Just as a precaution, I'm going to go long black box makers, I think.
You know what? I would go a little bit farther, though. I would say that it's not their job to know how big they should get before threatening the global financial system because they don't have that mandate, they don't have that authority, and they don't have all the data.
But in none of those cases were they threatening the global system.
I do think this is actually the key point, though. I mean, the question at the end is, if you are leveraged and you are in a crowded trade, you may get badly hurt. Are you more likely to avoid that disaster because you, the investor, are frantically talking to all your buddies in the business and trying to figure out how crowded it is? Or are you more likely to avoid the disaster because some government agency, which typically is slower and less incentivized to do it right, is going to give you the information?
But wait a minute here. I mean, one of the reasons for being in that trade in the first place is on the way up, the crowding has paid off handsomely.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's why it's very difficult for you to expect that hedge fund managers or any investors will voluntarily pull back and give up market share and profitability for the sake of preserving systemic safety. That really is the role for regulatory oversight. I'll give you an example, a very simple example. If you were the chief risk officer in Lehman Brothers in 2005, and you knew full well that it was a crowded trade, and as Mr. Chano said, everybody does know and did know back in 2005 that mortgage-backed securities was a crowded trade. Nevertheless, in 2005, you're making a lot of money from that business, and Lehman Brothers worked hard to gain market share. If you were the chief risk officer of Lehman Brothers in 2005, what would you have recommended to the CEO, knowing full well that it was a crowded trade fraught with risk? Would you say to the CEO, it's time to get out of the mortgage-backed securities business. Let's just shut down the whole unit. This is a unit that's been contributing record profits to your company for the last 8 years.
Well, maybe not to that CEO, but, you know, the
famous one, right?
Yeah.
As long as the music is going on, we have to dance.
Well, moreover, if you did shut down that unit, what do you think the shareholders would say? Shutting down a multi-million dollar business.
I mean, I think
this gets back to the issue, I want to address this quickly, the question of kind of who's allowed to do what. In other words, I haven't heard, maybe you have examples, I haven't heard yet of a crowded hedge fund trade that created systemic risk because of what the hedge fund industry did. I mean, we're sort of assuming something that might not have happened, if you know what I mean. If you keep coming back to the Lehman example, that was an example of a regulated institution that got over-leveraged, right, and was taking on certain kind of hedge fund activities inside their own, on their own balance sheet. It gets back to...
And not accounting for them accurately. I keep coming back to that. That makes a big... There's an asymmetry here.
LTCM was a trade.
LTCM, it might be the example, right, in that case.
You don't have to mark those positions accurately. You can take risks and convince your shareholders and senior management with the wrong reporting that you're doing just fine, when in fact you're not. And I can't stress that enough.
Let me just, before going to the audience, ask Peyton Young one question. You know, you raised this possibility that the hedge fund manager would put money in an escrow account and sort of said it was implausible. But actually, when hedge fund managers have their own money in the fund, That's the same thing, isn't it?
No.
They lose the money if it goes wrong. If they have a significant portion of their net worth, then they're...
If I had a blackboard, I could show you that that's not the same. But at any rate, there are two. Let's distinguish the two. First, it's a good thing if the manager has a big stake in the fund. I mean big. Mm. But it's not enough that it be big relative to the fund. It has to be big relative to the manager's whole wealth. Right. I mean, there's a trick here that you can do, which is if I'm, you know, a billionaire, well, I can have big stakes in 10 funds. And, well, you know, so one or two of them go bust completely. That's okay, because I've made tons of money on the others. So that's just a way of spreading your risk around. So it's not enough to just talk about having a large stake in a given fund. What I was talking about was, as in Lloyd's of London, this is a really drastic proposal that I do not believe would ever be taken seriously. Yes, you post a personal bond. Yes, and if there's bad performance for, say, 2 or 3 years running, you have to sell your house and everything else. They go after you. There's effectively no limited liability. And that would be a corrective, but one that won't work either. Why? It'll keep everybody out of the market. I mean, essentially, you won't get any of these innovators who would want to open under those terms.
Don't general partners have unlimited liability anyway?
Not in the sense that I'm just talking about. No, they don't go after your house and your future income, which is really possible with Lloyd's of London, but that's a really drastic and extremely rarely used incentive device, and I'm trying to say that even then it won't work.
There's another proposal that managers take their incentive compensation in the same way it's earned, i.e., if you have unrealized unrealized gains and losses, for example, level 3,
yes.
Whack it up into a manager's...
So UBS proposed that, right?
Yeah. Well, they paid their... See, I think Credit Suisse paid people.
Oh, Credit Suisse, right.
Paid
right,
people
right.
in that form, and there's a certain sort of elegance to that, yeah. I guess, where if this is what you're putting on the books and this is what you're booking as profit, take it back.
So all the bonuses, even we can carry that over to the banking industry right now.
Well, actually, we should have done that in the banking industry. That was my point I've been making all
along. Well, we're still paying the bonuses. Let's do it in toxic assets.
Well, it's actually... take a lot of risks, have high rewards. You should have an asset allocation strategy where you have a small amount of your assets allocated to that. Similarly, I personally would not want to invest with a hedge fund manager who had all his assets and his net worth kind of in the fund, because that would tell me about some of that person's propensity for risk. It would make me a little concerned about the person I was investing with. I'd rather be investing with someone who had a more thoughtful, broad-based allocation strategy themselves. It is a good thing that private equity funds and hedge funds take risks. That's where the returns come from, and that's where the social benefits to the economy come from, because when those risks pay off, we're generating wealth that taxes are paid on and enterprises that hire people. That's important. We don't want to drive risk out of the economy. We want it to be managed correctly and carefully.
Actually, can I follow up on that comment? Because I think that's a very important point. And Mr. Hutchins made the point earlier as well that we have to keep in mind that while we are talking about the hedge fund industry in this panel, that's what this session is about, that a significant fraction of the dislocation that has been talked about has happened outside of the hedge fund industry. In fact, the biggest form of dislocation is related to this issue of risk-taking. It's risk that is being inappropriately taken by the wrong parties. In other words, losing money is not a problem. Hedge fund investors and managers have been losing money for decades. And as long as you're prepared for those losses, that's fine. That's part of capital formation, taking risks and ultimately, in some cases, bearing those consequences. The problem comes, and the reason that we are in such dire straits, when the wrong parties who didn't think they were bearing the risks that they ultimately bore end up losing money. So when a money market fund who invested in AAA securities ends up losing 30% of their investment, that's a problem. And that's something that is happening outside of the hedge fund industry in the banking industry, which, by the way, is the most highly regulated industry in the world. So I think that what we're talking about today has to be put into context of the larger issues about how we're going to reform regulations for all financial institutions, not just hedge funds.
Okay, let's go to the audience. There's a question right in the front here to start off with. I'll go around the room after.
Thank you. I'm Robert Schroeder, president of International Investor, and I think this panel has been skirting an issue that I believe is the biggest transparency issue of all. I'm not concerned about the individual investors who, as you point out, Mr. Janus, should be well-educated and understand the risks before they enter into these. But we're all very concerned when this activity starts threatening the entire financial system. So the transparency question that I'd like to pose is, and the reason I believe that this industry certainly needs to be regulated, is the connection between the commercial banking world and the hedge fund world. In 2007, by some estimates, over 50% of the commercial banking activity and profits relied on trading activity and lending to the hedge fund and private capital world. Much of that, of course, doesn't appear on the balance sheets of the commercial banks, and it certainly doesn't appear on the balance sheets, which we never see in the black box hedge fund world. If you or I try to get a loan from a commercial bank for our business or personal loan, we have to show everything to them in terms of a credit report so they understand the risk involved in lending to us. The hedge fund industry would keep much of what they were doing secret so they could leverage up to 50, 100 times in some cases, because they were able to convince commercial banks, because they were willing to pay higher interest on those loans, that it wasn't important for them to understand how many other debts or liabilities they had on their balance sheets.
Okay, well, let's see what...
All right, so my question is this.
Okay.
When it comes to lending from the commercial banking world to the hedge fund world, does the Federal Reserve even know enough at this time? Does the Treasury Department fully understand the implications? Or are they actually holding a lot of the information back as they slowly uncover some of the liabilities that these commercial banks have to the hedge fund industry?
Okay, who would like to?
Well, first and foremost, the type of lending you're talking about, I believe, is almost all collateralized. You understand that. It's not unsecured.
In the form of stock?
In the form of if borrowing to finance bond positions, stock positions, whatever it might be, the banks aren't that stupid.
Financial assets.
Financial assets. Collateralized, but with a haircut, usually. Now, what happens as the credit cycle goes on and people get emboldened, as in all credit cycles, the haircut gets less and less. The banks are willing to extend more credit on any given security. If we go back to LTCM, which you know well, I mean, at one point, supposedly the leverage was $100 billion on $3 billion of equity or more. But keep in mind, there were assets, or at least the lenders thought they had collateral, secure assets against their loan, maybe to collateralize 120% against the value of the loan or 110% against the value of the loan. The problem is the assets became more illiquid. As someone said, you know, assets can be ephemeral, debt is forever. And that, as credit cycles go on, creates the problem. But please be clear, by and large, that this type of lending does not go unsecured. At the prime broker level or at the banking system.
There's a further point, isn't there, that after 1998, in the LTCM episode, it was the case, just as the question suggested, that the banks had lent to LTCM without asking, how much money did you borrow from all these other banks?
Aggregate, yes.
And in aggregate, it was such that they were not going to get their money back. That's why, in the end, they
everyone thought their own position was secure, right. But everyone trying to get out through the, again, the crowded trade phenomenon destabilized the system.
I don't want to comment on this, but my understanding is that in the past decade, you know, that lesson at least was absorbed, that banks now push for more information from hedge funds about one or the other.
Hedge funds have become much less levered as banks became more levered, by the way.
I don't actually, I'm not proposing this as the solution, but I mean, in the insurance industry, there are long-standing ways of dealing with this. I mean, there's forced diversification. So an entity is regulated heavily, and the way they do it is you can't take, you know, put more than, say, 5% of your risk in any one sort of pot. And this applies to earthquake insurance, flood insurance, right. Things like that. And so you can see that there would be a possibility of applying this same principle to banks or even large hedge funds, that there actually be forced diversification to avoid this piling up phenomenon. But that would be going way beyond where we are now. All I'm saying is there is precedent. using the insurance industry as a model, which, by the way, I think actually is quite similar in some ways to our modern financial institutions taking huge risks.
But I think let's get back to this point here. The question, which is a very good one, really pertains to the capital structures and lending practices of already regulated institutions. And so there's nothing in the hedge fund regulation that's going to propose regulation that can and should and will address that, because that's about kind of what the balance sheet of the big banks should look like and what their lending practice should be. And so that will of course be a very important part of what the new financial services regulatory structure is.
By the way, I think you're incorrect. I don't think half of the earnings stream, for example, of Citibank comes from dealing with hedge funds.
No.
Well, trading activity is different. Trading for their own account. For their own account. Not trading with hedge funds, trading for their own account. That's a much different animal. I alluded to that earlier in saying that banks and brokers were the largest and are the largest hedge funds, in effect, because of that activity. But again, as Glenn points out, they're already regulated.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, it's much has been made of the fact that hedge funds are part of the so-called shadow banking system. But I think the question points out the reverse, and something that Mr. Chanis mentioned, which is that banks are now part of the shadow hedge fund system. Mm-hmm. And the problem the problem is not so much that it's the prime brokerage activities, but it's the proprietary trading, coupled with the fact that banks have this wonderful facility where when they buy certain assets, they actually don't have to mark them to market until maturity, which is a wonderful gizmo that I wish hedge funds would have access to, because it would allow them to do.
Don't start that now. We have enough problems.
Nobody's proposing that.
But this ability to not have to mark your assets to market is one of the reasons that we have created the problems that we have today. And the so-called toxic assets that sit on these bank balance sheets, I feel like I have to speak out for that, because I think toxic assets is a very pejorative word. There's no such thing as bad bonds, only bad prices. And so I think that with the proper pricing, we can actually get around these problems quite effectively.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go out to the audience. Let me see. Maybe the gentleman with the purple tie over there.
Bruce Smith from Brookings Retired. I sat and watched the bankers yesterday, and they were very impressive by and large. I especially liked that Jamie Dimon. He was very good. But the upshot from that was that we really have the tools we now need. So I have a solution that I borrowed from Anders Osland and I think one other colleague. Let's say we go through this stress business and we decide what constitutes stress in the banks. And it's not really your problem. You want to pile on to the regulated sector where the problem really is, including in the Fannie and Freddie, the most regulated. But okay, we identify now what is a toxic asset, and I think we do suffer from a bad metaphor there, as if this, is radioactive spreading all over, killing everybody. Okay, so we take the toxic asset and we put not in one big thing, but each bank has its own bad bank. We segregate that into the individual bank's bad bank. And we don't liquidate things right away. Let that go for 10 years, 15 years, let them figure out what to do with it. With the rest, now the clean part of the bank, we recapitalize because that is now clean. It's put in its, I don't know what legal form it is, a wholly owned subsidiary, but it's sitting over there to be gradually worked into the market somehow. And the banks, meanwhile, have become healthy. Is that a possible?
Let's actually go to the next question here in the front from Daryl. I take that as a comment on bank recapitalization more than a question on hedge fund regulation. If others want to come back to that in a second, we can, but I would like to go to the next question.
Well, isn't that the problem really is the banks, not the hedge funds?
Fair enough, but this is a panel about hedge fund regulation. I agree with you, but, okay, right, question.
I'm Daryl West of Brookings. I have a question about the international aspects of regulation. How much of this, in regard to hedge funds, should be an American conversation versus how much should it be the United States negotiating uniform standards that apply to everybody, regardless of country of origin?
Who'd like to get a crack at that, Jim?
Well, having just read the FSA paper on short selling, which was released last week, and having addressed the AMF personally a couple weeks ago in Paris, as well as EU regulators, I mean, everybody's kind of, is trying to come to grips with these issues and is talking about uniform standards. But on a practical matter, everyone is looking at two countries, the U.S. and the U.K., as leaders, really, in regulation and in the thought process, and are going to look off of that from a practical matter. I think that but of course, hedge funds are global. And despite my earlier comments about the offshore system, I think that we have to understand that there are managers in London who are trading things in New York and vice versa. I personally have offices in both cities and go back and forth quite regularly. And I think that there does need to be some global framework through the G20 or G7 vehicles to get some sort of coherent standards. But I think this is a case in which if the regulators in the UK and the US lead, I am reasonably certain that most of the important industrialized country financial regulators will come into line. I think waiting for a broad consensus might be too long. I mean, we'll be an missed opportunity. Someone's got to show some leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's probably impractical to expect that there would ever be uniform standards for regulations. You know, we have an international organization called the United Nations, and we can't even agree on, you know, international coordination and uniform standards for genocide. Never mind financial regulation. So I guess
we're not suggesting that they're the same. Right?
No. But I would suggest that what we
genocide.
Should do is to have international coordination. I mean, that ultimately, I think that will be the best we can hope for. And I think the regulators are engaged in that right now. They should probably be doing more of it because there are regulatory arbitrages that hedge funds engage in across these various different jurisdictions. But if there's more coordination, we can close up a number of those loopholes.
I think it's fair to point out that there's a lot of total nonsense spoken about this idea of the need for international coordination because finance is global. It has to be globally regulated. The truth is that if you're trying to look at systemic risk in the US markets, most of the actors that you care about have a physical presence in the US. Never mind that they're registered in the Cayman Islands. They are physically here. They come here. And therefore, they are subject to U.S. law enforcement. So you don't need to worry. But Peyton wanted to say.
Well, the other way you can, at least in part, deal with this is ring fence schemes in which there's sort of those who are adhering to an international regime and those outside. And what you do as part of the internal regime is you restrict, say, lending activities across the boundary. So that would be part of the regime that can be enforced by, say, the U.S. and the U.K., and that leaves others outside of it at, you know, sort of at loose ends. They don't have any sources of funds or not as many.
Let's go to the gentleman with the yellow tie back there.
Alan Madian, LECG. I wondered whether some members of the panel might comment on the benefits and costs of imposing a cap on leverage for hedge funds.
Well, I'll be happy to start. So I think that the benefits, of course, are that, you know, we have some limitations on the kinds of risks that hedge funds pose to the financial system. But I think the costs might be quite a bit more significant in the sense that leverage across different hedge funds means different things. In some cases, very high degrees of leverage actually poses very little risk. And what it depends on is the underlying riskiness of the hedge fund activities. For example, those of you who've ever taken out a mortgage with 5% down, which is what my first mortgage looked like many years ago, that's 20-to-1 leverage right there. But at the time, it was relatively less risky than you might think nowadays. So the kind of leverage, the degree of leverage that you use, very much needs to be keyed into the kind of risks that underlie various hedge funds. Now, one of the benefits of having a central regulatory authority monitoring the leverage across various different hedge funds through prime brokers is that they can make these types of decisions as a function of market conditions. During business cycle peaks, I think it's a lot more important to pull in the reins than during business cycle troughs. And so the hope is that we can actually engage in exactly that kind of limitation, but in a somewhat smarter fashion to be able to help buffet the ups and downs of our business cycles.
I've been told we have to wrap up pretty soon, so let me just close up with one question I want to ask. It's one question I want each of you to answer it briefly, which I think kind of draws it all together. We've all agreed, and it's already the case, that various types of indirect regulation already exist for hedge funds. It's also the case that the system has looked at direct regulation in the past and backed off. If you had to predict whether this time there will be some form of direct regulation, and secondly, should there be, what would that particular direct intervention be? Let's start with Professor Lowe.
Well, if I had to predict what kind of regulation there would be, I would argue that there will be more regulation for the hedge fund industry, and that form will take registration of hedge funds with the SEC. I don't believe that that will address the issue of systemic risk, and I'm hoping that there'll be additional regulation that would compel hedge funds to provide information to regulators through their prime brokers and for creating the separate independent watchdog agency to focus specifically on systemic risk.
Good. Peyton.
I'd pretty much give the same answer with the additional proviso that something like a government agency that simply does regular reporting on the industry. So it's not regulating per se. It is, and nor is it necessary. Well, I agree that it should look at systemic risk measures, but a step before that is simply the provision of reliable information across the whole swath of hedge funds, their risk exposures and so forth, without giving up proprietary information. We would be a lot further ahead if we just had that information today.
Jim.
I would echo those two and say that, again, going and looking at the President's Working Group best practices would be a good place to start because it embraces a lot of what you just asked for. And I would agree, as a betting man, I would agree we're going to see direct regulation, but I suspect that it will be of a regulated disclosure as opposed to open disclosure regime. I also suspect that there will be ultimately a regulatory body, whether new or within an existing body, for systemic risk, and hedge funds will fall in under that rubric through their prime brokers and banks.
I think that's right. The only thing I would add is there'll obviously be a part of this, and maybe it's subsumed in what you've talked about, that'll be about investor protection, so the Madoff type of scandals have a much lower probability of happening.
Okay, we have 4 votes out of 4 for the idea that there will be some direct regulation. It's been a great panel. Thank you to everybody. And thanks to the audience.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well done. Bravo.